This is The New Criterion. I'm James Panero, Executive Editor. In just a few minutes, we will join Brian Brodeur as he reads from Some Problems with Autobiography, his new collection that is the winner of the 22nd New Criterion Poetry Prize, now out from Criterion Books. But before that, I wanted to sit down with Adam Kirsch, the New Criterion's Poetry Editor. Adam, welcome.
Thanks so much.
Adam is one of the judges of the New Criterion Poetry Prize. He is also the one who puts together the special poetry section for our April 2023 issue. And he has a new book out from Columbia called The Revolt Against Humanity, Imagining a Future Without Us. First, Adam, your book. Here you consider trends in anti-humanism and transhumanism. Is it the end of the world as we know it? And do you feel fine?
Well, the book is not poetry related. It's a little bit on darker subjects, but I do sort of come at some larger issues through the lens of at least literature and the humanities. As human nature itself changes, our ideas about humanity change. How does that change our culture? How does it change our spirituality, the way we think about ourselves and our purpose? And in this book, I'm looking at people who, from extreme points of view, think that the disappearance of humanity would not be such a bad thing.
Mm. So anti-humanism, what is that?
When I talk about anti-humanism, I'm looking at people who usually for ecological, environmental reasons think that humanity either should or already has doomed itself to disappearance due to climate change or species extinction, and who think about ways to value a world in which there is much less human presence or maybe even none at all.
Wow.
So they think about things like, can objects, can animals or even stones or rivers have some sort of valuable experience? If there were no human beings on Earth, would that still be a good world? And some of the more extreme ones say that yes, in fact, it might even be preferable.
I see. If a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it.
Exactly. It's still a good tree.
Still a tree. And how about transhumanism? What's that?
Transhumanism, I am looking at people who are probably more familiar, people who think that miraculous new technologies are going to change us so much that in the future, Homo sapiens as we know it will no longer exist, will have transcended it either by altering our own bodies and minds or by creating some other artificial form of mind to replace us.
Is that a good thing?
Well, the transhumanists definitely think it is. They think that the destiny of humanity is really to keep the march of mind going forward, that we are sort of the only bearers of intelligence in the universe that we know of, and that to keep spreading intelligence and keep advancing, we have to transcend our biological limits, which means uploading our minds onto computers or designing completely new kinds of minds that can do things that we will never be able to do, like colonizing the far reaches of the universe.
On to, let's say, less trans topics, the April issue. It's a superb selection this year. Some new writers here for us and big names all around. I wonder if you'd take us through what you put together.
Absolutely. Well, April is the cruelest month according to T.S. Eliot, but at the New Criterion, it's my favorite month because it's the month when we have our special poetry section. We try to bring in interesting writers to write essays on different poetic topics and also publish some kinds of poetry that are a little bit different than what we usually do. So this year, we have a couple of poetry features. One is from a book called The Lamb Cycle, which is a very fun and clever book by a poet named David Eubank, in which he takes the old nursery rhyme, Mary Has a Little Lamb, and rewrites it in the style of the great English poets from Chaucer on to the 20th century. And we've published a selection of these, imagining what would this nursery rhyme be like if Shakespeare had written it or if George Herbert had written it. The other poetry feature we have is sort of a rediscovery, an African-American poet from the 1920s named Georgia Douglas Johnson, who in her day was quite well known, but I think has pretty much fallen out of the public memory. We have taken a selection of her work that was first published in 1922, three poems in which she talks about race and her experience as a black woman in the U.S. at that time in ways that I think will be new and interesting to a lot of readers.
And I gather one way you start to put this together is you see what books are coming out in April
and look
to do a serial.
Often it's a serial or a translation. April, because it's National Poetry Month, is a month when a lot of poetry titles come out. So it's a good time to to find some lesser-known things, some things that aren't maybe going to get as much attention from other publications, but that suit the New Criterion perfectly.
I mean, how about Ian Bostridge?
That's right. Cool. So one of our essays this month is by the great singer Ian Bostridge. He's a singer of opera and lieder who's English and also a writer. And so we have excerpted from a new book of his a section about his thoughts on performing the Robert Schumann song cycle, Frauenliebe, which is about a woman who is preparing to get married. And in it, in this essay, he talks about the biographical circumstances behind these songs, which Robert Schumann wrote when he was preparing to get married to Clara Schumann. His wife was also a famous musician, and his taking poems that were written from the wife's point of view and sort of infusing them with his own experience as a husband. And then Ian Bostridge talks about male and female singers performing these songs and the different things they bring to it.
And we were just talking before about the title A White Russian on the Rocks, which I must credit my colleague Rob Erickson for coming up with that title. So tell us about this feature.
Well, this is a really unusual and interesting discovery, I think. The poet Boris Dralyuk, who is himself a Russian-American and translates from Russian, lives in Los Angeles, spent most of his life in Los Angeles, and he has discovered a lot of writers, Russian emigre writers, who after the Russian Revolution sort of ended up in Los Angeles. We hear a lot about Russian emigre writers in places like Berlin or Paris, like Vladimir Nabokov, but there were also a number who ended up in Hollywood and even acted as extras or bit parts in Hollywood movies. And so Boris has found a sort of completely unknown writer named Alexander Voloshin, who wrote a mock epic in verse in Russian about this community, about Russian exiles in Hollywood. And so in this essay, he sort of introduces us to Voloshin and also translates some generous selections from this mock epic. It's a real discovery. I don't think I've ever heard anyone talk about or even refer to this book. And it's really fascinating.
Well, also new to me was the piece by Torquil Duthie. Tell us about that.
Torquil Duthie is a scholar of Japanese literature. And so for this essay, what he's done is written an introduction to the Kokinshu, which is sort of the classic anthology of Japanese lyric poetry from the 9th century, I believe. It is a book that I think is basically unknown in the West, but in Japan is at the very foundation of all subsequent poetry. It was notable because it was the first collection of poetry written in Japanese vernacular rather than in Chinese characters, which was sort of the language of the educated class until then. And this is poetry that functions in ways that are very different from the English poetry that we're used to. And so in this essay, Duthie explains what are the conventions, what are the themes, and how we can appreciate this poetry.
And bookending these pieces are two subjects very much in our wheelhouse. We have James Matthew Wilson on T.S. Eliot's Still Point leading off the features.
That's right. So James Matthew Wilson, who's been featured in the New Criterion before as a poet, is joining us this month as a critic writing about T.S. Eliot, and he's taking stock of some new recent biographical and critical studies of Eliot, but really offering a pretty comprehensive argument about Eliot's career and why his work is valuable. He sets him in the context of ideas of power and violence in the 20th century and how Eliot's Christian faith offered him an alternative way of looking at the world, looking at his career as a sort of progress from this world dominated by power and violence to one where there could be peace and faith, especially emerging in his late religious poetry.
And as the cleanup hitter, I guess we could say, William Logan on Auden.
That's right. William Logan, the New Criterion's veteran poetry critic, is writing about a new edition of Auden's collected poetry, and as he always does, he is not afraid to say where he thinks the work is not as good. He points out some of the problems with the later Auden and also gives credit to Auden at his best. It's a really interesting survey of the career of a poet who, more than most poets of his stature, produced a very uneven body of work.
Well, and these complete works is a big deal, this publication.
That's right. It's a giant two-volume edition that brings together everything that Auden wrote over the course of his career, which is quite a lot.
It's almost 2,000 pages combined.
Right.
Well, very soon we will gather to celebrate the new Poetry Prize collection. I wonder if you could tell us something about this this winning book?
Well, every year at this time, we celebrate the winner of the New Criterion Poetry Prize. The prize is an open contest. Anyone can submit, and it's awarded to a manuscript of poetry that is attentive to form, is how we describe it. It doesn't have to be strictly formal, but it often is. And Brian Brodeur is a poet who makes wonderful use of form and meter and rhyme while writing about very contemporary themes and subjects, current events and domestic life, life in the Midwest where he lives. He's a professor in Indiana, and this is his fourth collection. I think it's a really strong, really interesting book. I'm delighted that we're going to be celebrating it tonight.
Adam, thank you as always. Now let's turn to Brian as he reads from Some Problems with Autobiography, with prefatory remarks by you and Roger Kimball. Adam, thanks again.
Great, looking forward to it.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm Roger Kimball, the editor and publisher of the New Criterion. I'm delighted you come and join us for the celebration of Brian Brodeur's Some Problems with Autobiography, the latest edition of our Poetry Prize winner. We're really, this is, I think it's maybe the single most attractive one we've done yet, and the poems are pretty good too. So we're very happy to be able to do this. I think it's just maybe the 12th, 13th, 14th, it's 20, is it? Anyway, time flies when you're having a good time. So I'm delighted you could be here. I'm delighted Brian could come. Our April 2023 issue is here for the taking. Please take it. It's a special poetry issue, basically arranged by our poetry editor, Adam Kirsch, who also helped with the book. He was the person who oversaw that process. Adam will say a few words about Brian's book and introduce you to Brian, and I'm delighted you could be here. And by the way, the book also is yours for the taking, free and for nothing. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, everyone, for coming to celebrate Brian Brodeur's prize-winning Some Problems with Autobiography. I'm Adam Kirsch. I'm the poetry editor of the New Criterion. And so one of the most fun parts of that job is getting to be one of the judges for the poetry prizes along with Roger. And this year, the third judge was Carmine Starnino, the Canadian poet and critic. And we were very lucky to get a lot of great submissions, a lot of strong manuscripts. The contest is now open for this year as well. So if anyone out there has a poetry manuscript that you want to submit, we're reading. But I was delighted that we were able to publish, as the winner of the contest, Brian's really excellent book, which I admire very much, really enjoyed reading, and I think all of you will as well. As I was saying to him just now, the ability to write in a way that's formally controlled and masterful in that way, but also very contemporary and writing about real life and the world we live in, I think is rare and exceptional. So I'm really glad that we have this book as the 22nd winner of the New Criterion Poetry Prize. I'll just quote from the back of the book, my predecessor as the poetry editor here is David Yezzi, who says, by turns mellifluous, wry, and fierce, Brodeur can play every instrument in the orchestra. His poems are essential listening. So now we'll get to listen to him read some. Brian.
Thank you so much, everyone, for being here. Thank you, Adam, for a lovely introduction, and thank you, Roger, for publishing the book. So I won't take up too much of your time. I'll you know, read just maybe a few short poems, maybe one of the longer poems, but that'll be it. I don't know, four poems or so. Let's see how it goes. Maybe I'll start with one of the stranger poems in the book. So the book has a lot of, a handful of dramatic monologues, in the book. And this is one of the shorter and possibly one of the stranger ones. The premise of this is that the speaker is someone or something many, many years or ages hence when humanity is no longer, and this being is a kind of an individual member of the race that happens after us, that takes over. takes over the shop. So so the word wing in the title refers to wing as in wing in a museum. So this speaker is a kind of tour guide. The Anthropocene wing. What little we've reclaimed of what they were has become its name, a confection for the ear. Bush cricket, pupfish, amur tiger, man. We think these two divergent trend lines mean the rise of this one species brought the fall of all else. Elm trees, breeds of waterfowl. At first, we blamed a meteor, but now strong evidence suggests the white rhino and damselfly that mankind wanted this. They drank the black blood of their god until they drowned. We find them in the substrate still. Look how the cranium of this one has dry wells for eyes that seem to burrow down and down, yet they don't see. Shall we move on? Just for fun and just to represent the collection fairly, I'm going to read I'll read all sonnets or mostly sonnets. So that was one of them. And here's another. This one is a little... So I live in Indiana. I wasn't born in Indiana, but I find myself there. I have a teaching job there. And so this is a real Indiana poem. this one also has a strange epigraph, which comes from an article that I just happened upon a couple of years ago, just, you know, messing around online. The article is called Money to Burn, Economic Incentives and the Incidence of Arson. And here's the epigraph. But are some acts so egregious as to be immune from the profit-motivated incentives to perpetuate them? What we told the children. Oh, I should say, that the first line refers to five words, and those are the last five words of the poem. Oh, and also there's a, Like a River Glorious is the title of a hymn. So if you don't know that, that would seem strange. Okay, what we told the children. Just five words spoken through a tensed jaw. For Orpha Halsopfel, who still lives here, who called each horse and held each muzzle near to feed them mints before she lit the straw. For the duty officer, her son-in-law, who reached the stable first so he could clear the scene and bribe the fire chief, who, we'd hear, would overlook the charred oil cans he saw and click the act of nature box without approval or reproof, but as one of us who'd pass the paddock stacked with black barn poles on our way to pay respects with casseroles, who'd chorus like a river, glorious, and tell our kids the horses all got out. Thank you. Very nice of you. Oh, hell, let's keep it a sonnet only party. I'll read three more poems. this one also has a kind of a strange premise, but maybe not a strange speaker. The speaker is just, you know, the poet. But this comes from the Swedish-born philosopher Nick Bostrom, who does work in artificial intelligence and other things. And so he wrote, I think this is in the early 2000s, he wrote and published an article that you can just find it online anywhere, basically, but it's called, "Are You Living in a Computer Simulation?" So here's the epigraph, and then I'll read the poem. "Then it could be the case that the vast majority of minds like ours do not belong to the original race, but rather to people simulated by the advanced descendants of an original race. Algorithm. I smirk until my smirking wilts to doubt. How could I know I'm not? Knowing would be part of the code the engineers worked out as bits and bytes in high fidelity. The implications sting. No you, no me. No spouse or kids. No plot point we'd accept as plausible. Nothing to think or see we hadn't been pre-programmed for except this. If our species is an avatar, doomed not to live, but only interface, it's not impossible this super race might grope through its own simulated night. Unsure of what I glimpse in such faint light, I squint. Is that a satellite or star?" Okay, I'll read just two more sonnets. Sonnet party. They are the wildest parties, after all. Forget toga parties. Okay. Okay. I don't think I have to say anything about this poem. I read it to a group of colleagues a couple of weeks ago, and I introduced it as one of the funny poems in the manuscript, and no one laughed. So. So feel free not to laugh. This is another kind of a bleak one too, but the object of its bleakness is more personal. So, self-portrait, 2085. He doesn't look so good. Meat and marrow gone. Buttons of his frayed shirt shedding like coins of bone. In payment for such cramped real estate. Its lease with no option to buy. His mostly vacant sleeves fallen open in an attitude of, what now? Not much from this cutaway view of nothing new. Dust is at home anywhere. But above, the hum of crickets chittering summer's requiem pauses out of respect for a woman who kneels by mossy names. An automated bell knells its know-it-all refrain. What now? Well, who can say? Not him. Effaced by the grave's false clemency, his jaw still hinged and gaping, not as if about to speak, but waiting, as ore waits for the pickaxe's spark. Got a couple of laughs, that's good. So this will be the last poem that I'll burden you with. And so thank you New Criterion for publishing this book and for throwing this soiree and for inviting me to it. It's so astonishing when they invite you.
We thought of holding it without you, but you're missing something essential.
Okay, so this poem I read for my wife and daughter who are here tonight. My daughter's first trip to New York, so we went to the Empire State today and went up to the, not the very top, but the cheap seats, the 86th floor. I mean, how different can it be? I don't know. You tell me. You will. Somebody tell me. Or don't tell me. Oh, and the title of this poem, it's Primer, which refers to the, you know, the early textbook, a textbook for first time readers, sort of, you know, not like the stuff that you slap on the wall before you paint it. Primer. We'd hoped it would last longer. The last year, she let us hold her sleepy in our arms, hoist her on our shoulders to swat the air, conducting some mute fugue by Bach or Brahms. Familiar tune, this plaint, too soon, too soon. This antique ache we've struggled to oppose, to want the morning back in afternoon, and wish for evening as the late light goes. Though she still tells us both to tickle her, our knees creak and our swollen ankles pop when we tackle her, squeezing her hard to hear the squeals that stab our eardrums. Stop! Don't stop! On the drive to school, we take the back roads slow. Soon, this will all have happened long ago.